Welcome to the High Premises Files podcast with me, your presenter, Charlotte Howden. I'm an HG campaigner and the co-producer and presenter of the world's first documentary about hyperemesis. Sick, The Battle Against HG is available now on Prime Video in the UK and the US, with other countries following soon. The High Premises Files podcast acts as a voice for all women who are currently suffering with or who have survived hyperemesis gravidarum. Earlier this year, I was lucky to interview and record a conversation that I had with Michelle Nicholson. Michelle is the only HG counsellor in the UK. Not only is she a professional counsellor, but she also has suffered with hyperemesis twice and has now dedicated part of her career to helping other women who have gone through the same mental health challenges that she did and that she sees in a lot of hyperemesis survivors and sufferers. I thought it would be a good idea to pop our conversation into the podcast so that any of my new followers or my new listeners who may have missed out on the video earlier this year can take a listen to Michelle's invaluable advice and crucially, perhaps start to think about a way that they too can get help with their mental health and the trauma that they have suffered with hyperemesis gravidarum. Enjoy!
Hi Charlotte.
First of all, thank you so much for doing this. I should say, for anyone who's watching who's not seen the Sick film, we were really, really hoping to speak to you and lots of other people about mental health challenges anyway. And then obviously the coronavirus came along and prevented that. So I thought, you know what, it's not in the film, but let's speak to Michelle and hear everything you have to say about the mental health side of HG. And hopefully that will be great for the people who follow me. So thank you for agreeing to do this today.
You're very welcome.
Just let's kick off. Tell me a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and why you decided to start HG counselling.
Well, I qualified as a counsellor back in 2001. At that stage, I'd never heard of hyperemesis gravidarum. And then a couple of years after that, I became pregnant for the first time and was diagnosed with HG around week six. So quite a shock. Hadn't heard of it before. Just managed to about survive that pregnancy. Was housebound, bedbound for much of for several months of that. Went on to manage a second pregnancy, also hyperemesis pregnancy. I think at that point, my naivety managed to help me go on to do it again, thinking, oh, it couldn't possibly happen again. I had no idea of the recurrence rate at that stage. Then around 2013, I was still left with many questions about hyperemesis and wondering about the emotional impacts of it, really. And I think as a former social worker and counsellor, I was really surprised when I was so ill that other people like medics, midwives, didn't ask me how I was feeling psychologically. It was very much treated as a physical illness. Mm-hmm. So I think that stayed with me as a niggling question. Mm-hmm. So I went on to do some academic research on that in 2013. I spent a couple of years really reading about the history of hyperemesis care and interviewing other women about their experiences from an emotional perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think from that, I realised actually what I had experienced wasn't that unusual in terms of feeling that was being missed somehow. And I think one of the main outcomes of that research was a realisation that there isn't really sufficient mental health care available to women that are suffering with this chronic illness. Yeah. That's what really led me to set up hyperemesis counselling. I felt ethically compelled, to be honest, to do something about it, at least make a start in helping raise awareness, not just among healthcare professionals, but also, well, really particularly among other counsellors, that actually this is a thing that can be supported with counselling. So that was 2016, I set up hyperemesis counselling. It's just a very small private practice, just one day a week, up to five clients. My main role is actually in a university, so I work as a university counsellor for most of the week, counselling students. Mm. So high premises counselling is a small part of my week, but a very significant part in terms of raising awareness, which is what I've really tried to do since setting up. Mm. So the past 4 years, I've written several articles for publication in a range of journals, and I've been presenting papers at conferences to really get that awareness and knowledge out there.
It's so interesting because a lot of women I meet in the high premises kind of campaign community, they all came here like I did from the same place, as that we didn't know anything about the condition. Mm-hmm. And then we suffered with it, and we decided, right, we need to do something about this. So your story, I love hearing these stories. When you meet researchers and you think, and they say why they became interested in high premises where no one else was really bothered, because yes, they suffered with it and could see, you know, something has to be done about this. So I love your story. So from all your, like, the research you talked about, and obviously actually having a practice now, what are some of the common challenges and experiences that women with HG will face?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously every woman's experience of this illness is unique. Mm-hmm. But certainly I think from the past 4 years of clinical practice, I've noticed that there are some real common themes. Mm-hmm. That are, you know, tend to be experienced to some degree by most women. Right. I think one of the main things is isolation. I think it can be a really isolating illness. You know, you may be bedbound, you may be housebound, people around, you may have people physically around you, but then be left with that sense of people aren't really getting it. They're not really getting the severity of it, and just the impact that it can have on us psychologically as well as physically. Mm. I think that can lead to many women feeling overwhelmed. Anxiety and depression are certainly very common in my clinical practice in terms of the issues that we focus on. And that can be in varying degrees. You know, it can go from a mild low mood to a clinical level of severe anxiety or depression. So quite a range. But I think some degree of low mood and worry is very common for women with this illness. I think a lot of women feel disbelieved. They feel they try to explain their symptoms or the impacts of it to other people. And there's that sense of other people not quite believing that it could be that bad. Mm. And that can often, it can leave women feeling as though it's being minimised or discounted in some way. I think there's problems sometimes with in terms of bonding with the baby that you're carrying. I think for many women, the symptoms are so severe that we just focus on surviving the illness rather than having an opportunity really to bond with the baby at that stage, because we're in survival mode.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that also can have an impact on parenting. You know, if you have other children already, there's that the difficulties around not being able to look after your existing children because you're so debilitated. And that can have an effect psychologically, you know, in terms of mental health. Mm. Also, relationships with partners, family members can be really severely impacted by the illness. Sense of confidence, sleep difficulties. Overall, a sense of control. I think many women feel they've lost control of their lives, particularly women who've maybe been very busy, very organized beforehand, to suddenly not feeling control of your own body and your own life can be really destabilizing. Mm-hmm. And for some women, you know, that can get to the extent that it becomes completely unmanageable. And I think that's the stage for some women where they start to think, maybe have suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. To be thinking about, you know, how can I end this suffering? How can I escape this torture? And I think that really, to me, highlights the potential severity from a mental health perspective, that's how bad it can get for some women. And similarly, you know, thoughts about terminating a pregnancy. You know, I think the official statistic is somewhere between 10 and 15% of women, yeah, that go to terminate a wanted planned pregnancy due to the severity of the illness. I suspect the figure is much higher than that.
I think you're right.
But I think, you know, that's often something that goes through people's minds. And even for the women that don't go on to terminate the pregnancy, they're left with a lot of guilt and shame around even having those thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of factors there as you're talking through those. And what really resonated with me when talking in the sick film, I did talk about how I thought about suicide, and I did think about a termination. And when I was in hospital, I actually asked for one, and the doctor would, you know, said, look, that's an option, but thank God, let's see if we can get you through this. And I got better, which was great. But what was really interesting, and I wonder if you've experienced this, is that I had all those mental health kind of challenges, things I've never experienced before in my life. So, you know, and it's not a gradual thing, it's quite sudden. You know, and that was all happening during my pregnancy. And I think where I kind of went a bit wrong was, as soon as Henry was born, I was like, oh, it's over, I'm okay. And I didn't think about my mental health post high premises. So can you tell me a bit more about, you know, once you've survived it and hopefully you have your baby, what could happen next?
Yeah, I think it's something I see a lot in the counselling practice, is women coming for counselling for some support months or years down the line, thinking it's still there, it's still affecting me. And I think it's something that's underestimated generally. I think recovery and recuperation after a high premises pregnancy is quite a complex process, and it does take time. And I think for, again, each woman's experience will be unique, but there are, again, common themes that I've noticed in counselling women that have already completed their pregnancies. I think postnatal anxiety, postnatal depression, again, something that women experience during the pregnancy, but can also experience after, that can linger depending on how it's addressed or, you know, how soon it's treated. I think many women are left feeling as though they're changed by the experience. It can literally feel quite life-changing in terms of your view of yourself, your sense of identity, your confidence. I think many women are left with a feeling of guilt or shame around the whole pregnancy experience, the fact that it didn't go, it wasn't the pregnancy that they imagined that they would have. I think for many women, they go into the first pregnancy, particularly with the fantasy of glowing and doing pregnancy yoga and, you know, eating healthily and all of that. And then that has to go out the window with high premises, because you're forced into a position where you just have to survive. Mm-hmm. And if that means eating crisps and jammy dodgers, then that's what you have to do. But mm-hmm. I think that can leave women with a sense of guilt and shame around it not going in a way that was expected. Mm-hmm. I think anger also is a quite a common feeling that I pick up from women that I'm working with. And I think that can be anger towards healthcare professionals sometimes, in terms of not getting the support that they needed at the time. It can be towards family members and friends for not getting it, for not helping out, or just, you know, leaving them feeling so isolated in that, even though that's obviously not, wasn't intentional. Some women find it difficult to be around other women who are pregnant after high premises, you know, as a sense of kind of unfairness, injustice, resentment there. There can be a real fear for many women of going on to contemplate another pregnancy. And for many women, that's where it ends, that actually there's a sense of grieving, either in terms of involuntary childlessness, if they didn't manage your first pregnancy. But for other women, can be a disappointment about limited family size. Mm-hmm. So maybe having, you know, before the first experience of pregnancy, expecting you might have two or three children, but then after a high premises pregnancy, thinking, actually, I can't face that again. So a sense of grief and loss around that limited family size. Mm-hmm. There can be a relationship with food can be impacted. So for some women afterwards, there can be a kind of a changed relationship with food, a fear of some foods.
I know a lot of women talk about triggers.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. That can be a trigger for many women. I think that can be the case. Change relationship with the body, with your body image. For some women, they feel their body let them down in some way, in the fact that the pregnancy was so difficult. Mm. A sense of grief, and that can be on all kinds of things, a kind of a loss of the dreamed or imagined pregnancy, loss of time with partner, loss of time with family, just loss of functioning generally, loss of well-being. And then, of course, with the women that do go on to terminate a pregnancy, there's a kind of complex grief process that needs to be gone through, really, in terms of coming to terms with that decision making and hopefully working to a place of self-compassion with that, because I think that's a real theme for those women that I work with, that sense of real guilt, shame, sadness, loss. And I think part of the counselling, the therapeutic work, is around helping women move to that position of self-compassion and just really understanding that actually it wasn't about not wanting the baby or the pregnancy, it was about no longer being able to tolerate the physical suffering, which are very different things.
Absolutely. I think, do you know what, I've never heard it put like that. I love those two words, self-compassion. I mean, I don't know, maybe generalizing, but women, we do tend to beat ourselves up about a myriad of things in our lives. And what you've just described with hyperemesis, you're going through so many emotions. So you mentioned fear, grief, guilt, shame. I mean, just one of those on by themselves would be enough to deal with. So all of them may be possibly together, not for all women, but they could all possibly come together. And the first thing you do is kind of beat yourself up, don't you? And don't allow yourself to just think about being compassionate about yourself.
Absolutely. And I think that is certainly one of the main themes of the therapeutic work that I do, is encouraging women to increase their sense of self-compassion that way. And for some women, you know, the experience is so traumatizing that they are left with symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And that, again, you know, it becomes in varying degrees. So for some women, there are mild symptoms which they can most possibly manage by themselves with a few lifestyle changes or techniques or strategies that they can learn in counselling or online. But for some women, it is actually a clinical level of PTSD, right. So post-traumatic stress disorder, the more severe end. And certainly for those women, you know, they do really need a much higher level of clinical support to manage that.
Yeah. So if someone's watching this and they've listened to the things that you've said and some of the examples you've given, and they think, do you know what, that does sound like me. I do think maybe I am a bit anxious about things. Maybe I am depressed, or maybe seriously think that they have PTSD. What advice would you give to them now?
I think the main thing I would say is don't suffer alone. Just, you know, to seek support as soon as possible. Mm. And to be patting yourself on the back for that, not to be seeing that as a weakness in any way. I think asking for help is a really healthy life skill, and it's something we all need at some stage in our life, you know. So to be seeing that as a very positive step forward, to be seeking that kind of support. Yeah. And really, depending on the severity of the symptoms, I think it depends on the kind of support that might be most useful. So for some women that are maybe more mild end of hyperemesis, you know, they are struggling to cope, they are overwhelmed, but they are still managing to, you know, to keep themselves going. I think for them, something like pregnancy sickness support can be really helpful. You know, there's the telephone helpline, the peer support program for women who are currently suffering, and the forum, which is for women who are currently suffering and those who have survived a hyperemesis pregnancy. That kind of support can be really useful. Mm-hmm. I think as you go up the scale, if it's more of a more severe level of depression or anxiety, or certainly PTSD, then I think a GP would be first port of call, to let your GP know that you're struggling psychologically. Yeah. And if you're currently pregnant, to bear in mind that your midwife will be a source of support in terms of referring you to mental health midwifery services. So they are more widely available now around the UK. And I think, you know, mental health midwifery is a really important source of support for those women. Yeah. And to consider counselling, you know, for some women, counselling is an option either during or following pregnancy. Depending on, when you mentioned PTSD, depending on the severity of PTSD. So as a counsellor, I do work with women, maybe mild to moderate PTSD symptoms. But once it gets to severe PTSD, I find that counselling actually can trigger some symptoms and flashbacks. So talking about it, reflecting on it, can actually be triggering. And where that's the case, I would feel that counselling is then no longer appropriate. Mm-hmm. And I would be referring women to more specialist form of therapy, particularly something called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization reprogramming. It's a specialized form of therapy that's recommended by the World Health Organization, and it's particularly useful for people that experience PTSD. So it's the form of therapy that is used by soldiers coming back from war zones.
Wow, okay.
Kind of PTSD. But I would say it's equally appropriate for women who have had PTSD due to hyperemesis.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting to say, because obviously I would have thought you are an advocate for counselling and talking therapy. But it's interesting that even you recognise that actually sometimes it might not be the right thing to you. But if you reach out and start that process, and then someone is going to recognise that and support you.
No, I think counselling is not appropriate for all. I wouldn't suggest that it's something that everyone will benefit from. I think it really depends on the severity of the illness and your personal preference.
Yes.
So some people come to me, they've had counselling for other things before, so they're very pro-therapy, they get how it works, they're really keen to do that kind of work. Yeah. Other people are much more ambivalent at the beginning and come thinking, well, I'm not sure counselling would be helpful, but then in most cases go on to think, actually, this is really useful, I kind of get it now, I get the point of it. Mm-hmm. But some women, you know, pregnancy, sickness support, mental health midwifery may be more suitable for them. So it really is about, I think, following your own instinct with that in terms of what you need. But the main thing is to seek support from somewhere. It's not so important where you're getting it from. It's as long as it's some level of professional support from some service, I think that's the main thing. Yeah. And to bear in mind, you know, GPs can prescribe antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication. There are some that are safe to use during pregnancy and some that are also safe to use in combination with the hyperemesis medications that are most
Yeah. So if you are currently pregnant and suffering with HD, it might be a little bit easier maybe to, you know, because you see your midwife at regular appointments. So if you're thinking, okay, I don't want to do anything about it today, but I'm seeing her in 2 weeks, you could mention it then.
Yeah, or phone, you know, don't wait 2 weeks. If you're really feeling that low now, pick up the phone and ask to speak to the midwifery team over the phone and say, look, I'm struggling psychologically. What extra support can be made available to me? Because I think sometimes those services are reliant on women asking for help, because sometimes they don't know, they don't realise that they are suffering to that extent.
Sure.
But I think for any women who are suffering, you know, certainly ask for support. But there are other things that women can do just for themselves, you know, in addition to that support. And some of them seem quite simple, but they can be surprisingly effective and powerful. And I think one of the first things is to rest as much as possible. So this is more for women who are currently suffering.
Yeah.
I think rest is underestimated. If you look at the RCOG, the Green Top Guidelines, they do, you know, it's right up there as one of the treatment strategies for hyperemesis. Mm-hmm. But it's something I notice women often underestimate. So they try and push themselves, they try and keep going, they try and be superwoman, supermum, you know, while they're still pregnant. And I think the sooner you can give yourself permission to rest and accept that this is a severe chronic illness, the sooner the symptoms can sometimes feel more manageable psychologically. Mm-hmm. Pacing yourself one day at a time can be very useful psychologically. I think women sometimes come to me asking, you know, or saying, I can't bear this, I just want to know when it will end, when will the suffering end? And I think psychologically it can be much more helpful to focus on surviving one day at a time in terms of what you need to do to get you through to the end of the day. Women often feel very alone. They feel like they're the only woman suffering. I speak to many women on the phone who have never met another woman or spoken to another woman that have experienced hyperemesis, so they feel like they're abnormal in some way. I think reminding ourselves that we are part of a worldwide community of women who have survived and experienced hyperemesis can be quite helpful in our own minds, to recognise there are women all around the world who get it, get what that's like. To be focusing on a sense of good enough pregnancy. I think women often go into pregnancy wanting it all to be perfect, wanting it all to be wonderful, and then feel really disappointed that it is the way it is. But I think if we can reframe that in our own minds, that actually this is a good enough pregnancy, this is, you know, we are doing our best with it. It's the self-compassion again, really. Some women tend to compare themselves unfavourably to other pregnant women, either those with hyperemesis or those without. And I think that's always unhelpful. So something to be avoided as much as possible, again, with the self-compassion. I think really the main thing we can do is try and replenish our well-being. So to bear in mind that once we're that ill, our well-being has really diminished.
Yeah.
So it's about topping it back up again in any way, doing things that we can enjoy, even if it's for 5 minutes, even if it's lying down in a dark room. You know, it's something we can do, like listening to an audio book, or, you know, anything we can manage really to be replenishing that well-being, to find outlets for the feelings, the thoughts, to speak to other people about it. It might be pregnancy sickness support, might be a counsellor, might be a midwife, but just talk, speak out rather than bottling it up, because I think that's where the risk factor increases, is when things start getting bottled up.
Yeah.
And to find distractions, because it can be so boring and it can be so overwhelming with the nausea and the vomiting that literally it can be difficult sometimes to think how you get through the next hour, let alone the next day. And so to find distractions where possible, literally anything that will take your mind off from what you might be ruminating over and over in your head.
Do you think then from everything that you've said, I know, you know, with Henry's been my only hyperemesis pregnancy, so I wasn't expecting all of this, so I hadn't really planned to spend long amounts of time in my room by myself. So I'm just thinking, you know, for women who might want to go out and have another pregnancy, is there some worth in being able to plan for those things that will help you mentally?
Very much so. And I would say that's a big part of my role as a counsellor. Yeah. So I do work with a lot of women who have had one hyperemesis pregnancy, terrified of doing it again, but desperate for another child, and wondering how they can prepare themselves psychologically. And yes, I would say there are certainly things that can be done in terms of preparing mentally
for that. So if someone's watching now and they think, okay, I'm not going to do it next week, I'm not going to do it in 3 weeks, I'm going to do it today, what would you advise them to do? Call their GP, come directly to you, speak to friends first, or what would you advise?
I think, in terms of counselling generally, I think counselling can be a useful space, you know, a safe space to kind of process the experience of hyperemesis. So you can kind of clear the decks before embarking on another pregnancy experience. Yep. So it can certainly, you know, it's something that can be useful during pregnancy and something that can be useful afterwards, either in terms of planning another pregnancy or just processing the trauma of the first pregnancy.
Yeah.
It can enable women to make sense of what they've experienced in some ways, put it in some kind of order, feel more supported with it, feel less isolated, less distressed. Certainly an opportunity to think about how they might build a more robust sense of self-compassion and self-care. It can enable women to reclaim their voice in some ways. I think many women, even, you know, really confident women that were pregnant and confident beforehand, can lose their sense of voice during this illness. And I know that was the case for me. I'm usually quite outspoken, confident, happily challenge a midwife if I thought she wasn't doing something. So, but with hyperemesis, I could hardly speak. So, you know, and I think that counselling can sometimes give women that sense of reclaiming their voice and their confidence again, building themselves back up. The kind of space to acknowledge how bad the suffering was. But in terms of, you know, your question about the further question, the further pregnancy, I think building in coping strategies, so planning coping strategies for the next pregnancy, can be particularly helpful. And that's the case for women who are currently pregnant. So some of the counselling work can be around looking at coping strategies in terms of managing your time, managing your feelings, managing your thoughts.
Yeah. I've always been quite a big advocate for counselling, and I don't know whether, you know, you would agree with this, but for me, I think sometimes when you open up to, like, your loved ones or with people really, really close to you, sometimes they try to make everything better.
Yeah.
You know, like, their first instinct, because they love you, is to say, don't cry, don't get upset, don't worry about this, or it might not happen again. And whilst I do think it's important, if you don't feel like you could go to a professional to talk to someone,
yes,
I've always found counselling really beneficial, because the person opposite me hasn't tried to invalidate my experience,
exactly,
or over kind of, you know, support me and want me to shut the emotions down. So I've always found it really, really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of the counselling role, really.
Yeah.
And I think for those women that don't feel counselling is for them, like you say, there are other ways of expressing, of externalising some of that, either during the pregnancy or following, to talk to friends and family that do get it. You know, pregnancy sickness support can be very useful for that. The helpline, the peer support programme, you know, really, really helpful. Mm-hmm. For some women, they can find writing as effective as talking.
Yep.
That's something I've done quite a bit of research on myself before setting up High Premises Counselling. That was part of one of my research projects, was looking at the therapeutic value of expressive writing for women that have experienced this traumatic illness.
Yeah.
And that can be very powerful for women in terms of reclaiming voice, reclaiming confidence, ordering their thoughts. And it can be just as useful to externalise onto paper or onto a screen as it can to speak to another person.
Yeah. So I think from the questions I've asked you and what I've heard from you, I think self-compassion has definitely come out in our chat today. And just making that first step to reaching out to someone. And, you know, you might already know, like you say, you might have had counselling before and you just think it's not for me. But, you know, we've mentioned pregnancy sickness support. I have women from other countries who follow me. So, you know, the reciprocal organisations and charities in their countries, again, are great people to reach out to. But it's just really about making that first step. You know, and I think if you are planning another pregnancy, if you know you're going to lose control again, perhaps during the pregnancy, taking control now by trying to, it's difficult to plan, I appreciate that, but just putting some things in place could be really beneficial mentally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in terms of, this is my final question for you. So you're very aware of all the research and the, you know, the scientific kind of discoveries we've had about the genetic component of HG going on. How important is it, do we think, to also push the campaign forward that mental health is just as important as the physical side? And, you know, in my opinion, I almost feel like not necessarily mandatory mental health care, perhaps some women really won't need it, but there needs to be some kind of program or something that says, once you've got hyperemesis, call us, speak to us, speak to this person. It needs to be something in place, I feel, anyway.
I would agree. I think too many women are slipping through the net. Too
many
women are not being picked up by the healthcare professionals around them. I think, personally, I think it would be really helpful if we could start routinely screening for clinical levels of mental health distress in women as soon as they're diagnosed with hyperemesis, and then to monitor that throughout the pregnancy. You know, we have the tools, we have the measures in place for this already. We don't have any tools that are specific to hyperemesis. I think there could be some value in designing something for that.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, the tools we already have could be used to screen women for at least clinical levels of anxiety and depression, so that we can pick that up earlier, so that women aren't left to suffer without support for the periods that they are. So I think routinely screening would be really useful and not that difficult to achieve. It's something that a midwife can already do, a GP can already do within their usual appointments.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree that could be really helpful. I think where we're at the moment, I mean, I'm, as you've mentioned, I'm currently the only counsellor in the UK with a special knowledge of hyperemesis. That needs to be widened out. We need to increase access to counselling generally for women. And I think that can be achieved with a very small amount of hyperemesis awareness training for those counsellors.
Yeah.
We already have thousands of counsellors across the UK working in GPs, affiliated with GP surgeries or hospitals, or in the general community, that could be supporting women with just a very small amount of hyperemesis awareness. And that can even be just signposting them to the pregnancy sickness support website.
Yeah.
Just to speed up a bit, just to increase their knowledge. And then use their usual counselling skills. It wouldn't be, you know, that much to that difficult to achieve. But I think counselling is certainly not for everyone. You know, for some women, I think pregnancy sickness support, additional support from mental health midwifery or the GP might be more appropriate for some, really depending on the severity of the illness and the, each woman's personal preference. But I think we really need to work on improving access to mental health care generally, a kind of range of mental health care options for women with this illness, because it is such a chronic and debilitating illness.
And I think just talking about, you know, just us talking, and this is going to go online and people watching this will help a little, because they'll be watching two women who've both had hyperemesis talk about mental health, which doesn't really get spoken about specific to hyperemesis as much as perhaps other conditions, and be able to relate and think, okay, I'm going to speak to someone, or I'm going to look at, you know, alternatives, perhaps to counselling or however they do it. It's just another thing to add to the list, though, isn't it, of things to do for hyperemesis?
I think it can be empowering for women to ask for support.
Yeah.
So to kind of draw the line on it and think, actually, I've suffered enough, and now's the time to seek support, and to feel, you know, that that is really appropriate, a healthy thing to do.
Yeah.
And for those women who are currently suffering, I think to seek support at this stage will mean that your recovery and your recuperation from hyperemesis is not so complex, not so difficult.
Yeah, it's actually just exactly like the physical side of the illness. If you pick up hyperemesis, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks and get early intervention treatment, then, you know, the journey you go on is that little bit easier than if you're left until 20 weeks before a GP or a medical professional even gets to you. And I know that from my experience. So if we have the same kind of test and process for the mental health side, again, it's not going to cure. You're not going to have a cure instantly, feel amazingly better, but you're going to have processes in place and tools and, you know, in your toolkit of how to manage everything. Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks, Michelle. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I'll put your details up on underneath the post. Is it okay for women to reach out to you and get some more information or advice?
Yes,
or
my website talks about the cat, you know, how I work in terms of counselling. But if women are interested in booking a first appointment, then just contact me by email. My email's on the website.
Right, I will do that. Like I said, thank you so much for talking to me. Hopefully we'll get to work together in the future on something. If we get the sick film developed further, we can post COVID-19. I might be able to come and shake your hand and thank you for all the work that you've been doing for HD sufferers.
You're very welcome. And congratulations on the sick film. You know, I'm already getting feedback from some of my clients, actually. That, and you know, I think it's been really well received and really welcomed by women who have experienced hyperemesis, because I think there's something very visual and meaningful about being able to portray the reality of the situation in a way that books and articles can't do.
Absolutely. Thanks, Michelle. I'll speak to you soon.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye, Charlotte. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Hyperemesis Files. If you have been affected by anything that has been spoken about in today's podcast, please visit your local hyperemesis charity or speak to a healthcare provider. For more information about the documentary Sick, The Battle Against HG, please visit www.thesickfilm.co.uk.